History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We've learned they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to do something about it. You are never going to regret asking a few questions and taking some time to listen. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but we really do find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. When I first started interviewing World War II veterans 20 years ago, one recurring theme started to emerge from almost every single interview. Veterans sharing that what they thought we could most learn from the World War II era is just how united the United States happened to be, how everyone from the home front to the battlefield contributed, and how tyranny might not have been defeated otherwise. Unity is not uniformity, and in fact, unity is more powerful, more impactful, when it's clear how different the factions that decide to come together are. The last week has brought plenty of headlines. Some of you listening right now are over the moon excited about the direction America is taking. Others see it, frankly, as your worst nightmare, and still more aren't sure what to think. Unity is something many of us pray for, and if we're looking for a powerful example, we can look back to that World War II generation. And we better take notes quickly, because that generation is leaving us. We felt that way 20 years ago, but it's more decidedly evident now. A newly released projection from the Veterans Administration says just 66,000 World War II veterans are still with us. That's less than half of 1% of the 16 million Americans who served. In the weeks to come, we'll be meeting more members of that greatest generation from different parts of the country, but I want to take today's episode and celebrate a couple members of that generation who just celebrated birthdays. She turned 100, he turned 99. They don't know each other, but they represent two elements of that all-hands-on-deck unity that powered America's victory in World War II. Ladies first, and one of our last remaining Rosie the Riveters, contributing so much on the home front, just turned 100 in Clovis, California. Angie Schiappi.
We lived in Pittsburgh, California, and my mother had, at the time that I was about three, there was only five children. But my grandma lived with us, and my grandpa, and my aunt and uncle, because things were very poor then, and, you know, it took a lot of money to feed all those kids and all those people. And my mother was a sick lady. She had epilepsy. So my grandma took care of all of us. So as we grew up, I got real attached to my grandma. I went everywhere with her, everywhere. My father worked at the steel mill, wasn't making too much money. My mother made good meals, made them last a long time. No leftovers. And we were a happy family. Of course, I didn't know any better, no different, you know.
And your parents had both immigrated from Mexico.
Yes.
So when you talk about your mother's cooking, I've got to hear what was the best, because we live here in the San Joaquin Valley. There's a lot of good Mexican food around here. What did she make?
She used to make homemade tortillas, rice, beans, enchiladas, tamales, you name it, everything. And I could do the same thing.
You still make homemade tortillas?
Yes. I taught Becky, too. Becky makes good food, too.
You do the Christmas tamales also?
Yes. About 100 tamales every Christmas.
Wow.
Yes.
What time should I show up?
About 7 o'clock. We start early in the morning. I make my mole the day before, but it's been a tradition. We make tamales. I follow my mother's tradition. Every year she made them, well, since we were little.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, you said back when you were 3 years old. I mean, that's in the 1920s.
And yeah.
Those early years for you are the years that America was in the Great Depression.
And very bad.
You were one of eight siblings.
Yes.
What do you remember about those years, and how did your family get by?
Well, like I say, my father and mother, my mother was ill. And my grandma lived with us, so they pulled their money together and did the cooking together. And we had a old house, big house, and the kids were all piled up, you know, sleeping together, and we were happy. My father worked shift, day shift, night shift, and trying to keep us quiet when Dewey's trying to sleep. So I remember a lot of that. My mother had epilepsy, and I remember when she fell over a couple of times when I was little. And of course, it scared me, but we got used to it. But we were a happy family.
And I always talk to people in your age group, and I'm always fascinated by how different life was back then. But especially for women, for young girls. Mm-hmm. The world was a very different place compared to 2020.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember having some ideas of, hey, when I grow up someday, I might do this or that?
Yeah, I wanted to be a nurse. I wanted to be a nurse to take care of sick people because my grandmother was a midwife, and I went everywhere with her. She delivered a lot of kids there, a lot of kids. I didn't know what was going on. I just saw her get some rubber gloves and let's go. And I'd go with her, and I didn't know what she was doing, you know, but she was delivering children. She delivered all of us. And she told me what to do, but I learned a lot from her. I was very attached to her.
And how about your siblings? You got 8 kids in the house, and you said you're all sleeping practically on top
of
each other.
Oh, yeah. Well, my sister, Allison, Connie, and me slept in one bed, and I used to say, don't touch me. Just a double bed with 3 people in it, you know, don't touch me. Of course, I'd start screaming, and I was very thin, very, very sickly, too. I was anemic, had a bleeding nose all the time. I was cross-eyed. I was sickly, and I hated school. I hated school.
Why is
that? I was in the sunshine class because it was a special class for skinny kids. And that was me. I was sickly.
So they called it the sunshine class because you guys needed vitamin D from the sun?
Yes, and cod liver oil every day.
I guess it worked.
I think it worked. It stayed in me because I'm 95.
That's what I'm saying. And everyone can hear how sharp you are and how with it you are. So you hated school.
I hated it. The only thing I liked was the spelling.
Oh, yeah?
I was good at that. I do crossword puzzles.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, my spelling was, I loved it.
We get into your teenage years. You're going to high school?
Yeah, up to the 11th grade only. I started working in the cannery. Friends of mine started quitting school and working, and they says, we're making 75 cents an hour. So I says, I want to try it. So I did. And my mother got mad because she wanted me to go to school, and the truant officer came looking for me. And I says, no, I'm going to work. So I quit school.
What kind of cannery was that?
Asparagus in Daniel, California. The bus would take us.
There's a day that unfolded in there somewhere. I guess it would have been right before your 17th birthday, a month before, December 7th, 1941. What do you remember about that?
The war?
Yeah, Pearl Harbor.
Roosevelt was president, I know, and my father was very upset. But other than that, I don't remember too much more about that.
You know, I've heard over the years from people who lived in the Bay Area at that time that there were curfews, you had to black out your windows because people thought the Japanese may come there.
Well, the thing is this, on July 17, 1944, my father and mother had come to Fresno to look for a house because we were going to move. And in Port Chicago, about 10 miles from Pittsburgh, there was a big blow up, a big ship blew up.
Yeah.
And we could see it from our yard.
Wow.
The sky all red. And I lived in an Italian neighborhood. And the ladies out there were screaming that the Japanese had bombed us.
Wow.
But it didn't happen. No, it's just something that just happened over there. So I remember that July 17, 1944.
And back before that, with, you know, when Pearl Harbor happened, were your friends talking about this? Do you remember, you know, life changing where you lived at all after that?
Yeah, they started building a Camp Stoneman for soldiers there. It was a depot to go overseas. My father didn't like the idea of us living there with all those soldiers back and forth in the neighborhood. But they put a stop to them coming to the neighborhood. There was a lot of robberies and stuff. So he didn't like staying there. He didn't like living there. He wanted to come to Fresno.
When we talk about World War II, we talk about the soldiers. We talk about the sailors and the Marines and the airmen. But all the things that they were operating, the ships, the planes, the tanks, those really all had to be built. We didn't have those sitting around before the war started. And you and your family were very involved in building ships. Where, how did that start?
My father was working at the steel mill, and he had some friends who told him that they were hiring at the shipyards in Richmond, California, about 35, 40 miles away. And so he went and he got the job, quit the steel mill. And him and my brother went, and they started working there. And they told us that we should go and try to get a job there. So my sisters and I went with them, and we applied. And they said, yes, they want to be welders. They put us to welding school, and I didn't like it because that thing was too heavy. The hood, everything. I says, I don't like this one bit. So he says, okay, you can be a burner. It's easier. So that's how we started. That was in November of 1943. And we worked till July of 1944. All that time, building those ships. Getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, being there by 7, and working till 4 in the afternoon. They had 3 shifts going. A lot of people. There was hardly any men because they were all drafted.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of women and old people. old men and all women mostly.
Would your whole family work the same shift?
No, we'd all go. My father would drive us. He had a 1939 Mercury. And, you know, gas was rationed then. My father had to get stamps to put gas in the car. because we were working in the shipyards, he got extra stamps. Mm-hmm. That was hard. Meat was stamped too. Yeah, everything was rationed. He had to put the shades down. It was hard, very hard. And he would drive us in the morning. My mother would get up and make lunches for all of us. Or sometimes we'd buy the hot lunch there, half asleep, you know. And we didn't wear no clothes. Levi's and sweatshirts and flannel shirts and boots. Mm-hmm. That was my wardrobe all the time.
Were you ever concerned that you couldn't do that job?
No. I like to be around people. I'd like to be out in the, with everybody, you know, learning. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't hard work at all. Just carry the settling with you and you hook it up and, you know, do what you have to do.
Well, yeah, and I want to understand this process. But first of all, what kind of ships were you guys building?
Liberty ships. You're working three shifts very fast. Before you know it, was up. My father and brother were riggers. They would just tell the crane guy over here, you know, they wore helmets. So, yeah, my sisters were welders. They were spotters. They would put the seam together, and the horseshoe like this, and weld it. And then I would come and burn it out. That was my job. But it was fun. It was fun. We were making a lot of money.
Was that the Kaiser shipyards?
Richmond Kaiser. There was three shipyards, two, and three. We worked at number two.
Five of you were going every day.
Every day.
You think there was any family that had more?
Oh, yeah. A lot of our friends were going. Their families were all going. Same setup. They work in a different yard, but everybody was trying to make a buck.
Did you understand the significance of what you guys were doing?
Yes, I did. You know, we were doing something good, and we were making money. All of a sudden, we got money, you know, do what we want to do. That's why we came to Fresno, and we bought the house here, my father and mother.
With the money earned at the shipyard?
Yes. My father and mother were married in Fresno.
Okay.
In 1921 at St. John's Church.
Wow.
They lived in Delray, so that they wanted to come back to Fresno because the soldiers were taking over the town over there. We decided to move to Fresno.
Did you have a lot of friends from school or family friends who were sent overseas, who were fighting in that war?
A lot of my class went. My sister's boyfriends went, and had cousins who went, and neighbors. They all got drafted. A lot of Italian boys went, because it was Little Italy there, and we used to love to dance.
Yeah?
Oh, Glenn Miller. I got all his records. Yeah, they used to have street dances. Most of the neighbors knew how to dance, so that was a lot of fun.
So I'm trying to understand, you know, life at the shipyards. There's a ton of people there.
Mm-hmm.
You're working a long shift. You're working hard. How were you treated by everybody else there?
Very good. We had older guys who were our bosses. They treated us very nice. Don't lift that too much. Don't do this. Don't do that. You know, very nice. Because you're young, 18 years old. You know, you can lift anything.
And help me understand exactly what you did. You said you were carrying an acetylene torch around?
Yeah, carry it to the thing and then hook it up. And then when they needed any burning, I would take it over there and light it and do what I did. They called them horseshoes. And this was welding, holding this together. And I would have to take it out after the girls welded this.
All right.
So, yeah, and then I just toss it. They had a big bucket you toss it in. I had a boss that followed me around, helped me sometimes with the line. But it was fun. It was a lot of fun.
Did you see people's attitudes toward women changing because of what you were doing, what all you ladies were doing?
Not really. I was just treated very nice. And then if you needed a rest to go to the bathroom, they had a policewoman in there saying you could only be here 10 minutes. They watched you.
They wanted you to be
working. Yeah, they want you out in the field again. Yeah.
Yeah. What did you enjoy the most about your time as a Rosie?
Just being with the other women. I all had stories. My husband's overseas. My father's overseas, you know. Some were just alone because their husbands were gone. They thought they were doing their bit, too. I don't remember any of those ladies when I went to that thing because everybody's changed. Some of them worked in the shipyard with us, but everybody's changed so much. You don't remember who it was, you know. But, you know, every time they launched a ship, it was a lot of fun.
What would they do?
Oh, a lot of dignitaries came. They get the champagne bottle, whatever they do. And that was a lot of fun to watch. And then they had the shows. The USO shows.
Yeah.
The Andrews sisters came. Bing Crosby came. You know, at our lunchtime, they had a little stage. We'd sit on the ground and they perform. And that was a lot of fun for an hour.
Well, I guess that right there shows you the importance of what you were doing. Because that's the same treatment they gave the troops overseas, bringing Bing Crosby or Bob Hope.
When the other sisters came, my father loved it. He loved it. But then we saw Bing Crosby and Bob Hope came too. But I didn't care for him, you know. His jokes didn't do anything for me. We knew the war was going on, and we had to keep the shades down and, you know, do what they told us to do. You were living in the dark, really. He was tired of it. He didn't want to stay there no more.
You might have kept working at the shipyards if he didn't move you here.
We could have kept working, because all my friends were still working. Girlfriends that we had, you know, they were still working. And then we moved here, and I lost contact, you know.
So you would have been here when VE Day and VJ Day came around?
Oh, yeah. I was working at the Al drugstore for less money.
Can you help us understand how big a deal that was when that war that had been going on for so long was finally over?
Oh, everybody was cheering. Everybody was so happy. We had a lot of soldiers here and there. There was a couple of camps here, and they used to come in the Al drugstore. I used to work at the fountain. They came in with the uniforms, and everybody was hugging them. We were all happy. It was over with.
And none of your brothers ever got drafted or anything?
Oh, yeah. My three brothers all went. My brother Ernie got drafted first, and my brother Junior went in the Navy, and my brother Jerry got drafted in the Army. My sister Alice, her boyfriend, he was in Italy, and my sister Connie's boyfriend was in Germany. And I had friends in Pittsburgh, a lot of friends that had gone in the service, and a lot of them had passed away.
For someone who didn't live it, how would you explain the significance or the importance of you and all the other Rosies in the bigger picture of World War II and what ended up happening?
I always think about, where are they at now? You know, I've been there. I did that. I wonder what happened to these people. We were so happy, so young, doing all this and all that. I never thought that I'd get this old to think about it and look back to see what I did. I'm glad I did it.
And why does it matter? What do you think you accomplished?
Because I put my 2 cents in. I did my thing. At least I did something.
And if you weren't all doing it, then it might not have had the same outcome.
No. Mm-mm. I think about all the Rosies that, you know, are gone. They did their bit.
It sounds like this is something that you're proud of.
Yes, I am. I'm proud of it, yeah. Looking back, I'm saying, how could I have done that? You know, how could I have done that, you know? I was wild, you know. 18 years old, you're raring to go.
What are the things that you're thankful for?
Everything. My health, my kids, my husband, what I've got, everything. I do. I pray every day. Every morning, I sit at my desk, and I do a lot of novenas. I don't know if you know what they are, but I do a lot of rosaries, a lot of prayers, and I just thank God that I woke up.
What would you say you're most proud of?
My kids, my husband, my family. I love my family.
Angie Schiappi, 100 years old, and one of our last Rosie the Riveters. When we come back, somebody else who just celebrated a birthday 80 years after an ordeal that he was beyond fortunate to survive. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. On a week in which the VA announced that only 66,000 World War II veterans are still living, and that California has the most of any state with approximately 7,000, we get to hear memories from two of them who just celebrated big birthdays in the Golden State. We heard from now 100-year-old Rosie the Riveter, Angie Schiappi, and now the memories of a man who just turned 99. Once you hear Dick Burbine's story of survival, you're going to be amazed he ever made it to 20.
I started in 1926. My father was in World War I. He got mustard gas, and he died when I was 2 years old. My mother was a surgical nurse. She couldn't support us and work at the same time, so they sent us to Canada with my grandparents, Yarmouth, Nova Scotia. And I stayed there until 1938 when England and Canada went to war with the Germans. And I came back to the United States at that time. The first thing I wanted to do in 1942, when I was old enough, 16 years old, I joined the Merchant Marine. I tried to join the Marine Corps at that time, but I was colorblind, and they sent me down the hall, and they said, the Navy will take anybody. So consequently, I went in when I was 16 years old. I served all over the world in World War II, from the South Pacific to Japan to all the way to Russia and back. I was torpedoed on February 23rd, 1945, coming back from Murmansk, Russia. I am the last survivor of the last American ship sunk in World War II.
And we want to hear all about that. I'm interested, too, in your childhood, because you've told your story before. You've lived with it your whole life. It may not seem that significant. You just told us your father died when you were two, so you never really knew him. You're raised by your grandparents. Do you remember as a boy having some ideas of, hey, someday here's what I'm going to do with my life. This is what I want to be or what I want to do?
When I was in Canada, 90% of the people there were fishermen or sea captains. My granddad was a sea captain. And I became interested in going to sea at that time when I was a young child. And I always had fond memories because every time we went to the big city of Yarmouth, he took me down to the fishing schooners. And he knew all the fishing captains and all that. So it was instilled in me as a young child that the seaman life was the way to go. And consequently, I followed that idea.
And I know to live here in Bridgeport, California at 6,500 feet, you have to be able to tolerate some cold weather a little bit. But I want some perspective on this. Growing up in Nova Scotia, what kind of temperatures or conditions were you dealing with?
We dealt with snow 6 months of the year. Cold weather, 40 below zero at times. We had what you might call typhoon-type weather. Storms, rain, heavy snows, and blizzard conditions from days at a time, and consequently I've grown up that way, and it didn't bother me. I'm here in Bridgeport now at 42, 45 below zero. It's another sunny day.
Well, we're going to hear something maybe even more challenging than that by the time we're done. Another thing I'm interested in, and maybe there's something leading up to this, because you told us you wanted to sign up for the Marine Corps at 16, but you would have been, I guess, 15 when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. And most guys I talk to have some kind of memory of that day. Do you remember December 7th, 41?
My brother and I were in the movie theater when it was announced that Japan had attacked the United States. And as soon as we got out of the theater, we said, we're going to join. At that time, I was just coming under 16 years old. And I made a vow to myself that when I was 16 years old, I was going to go and fight those bastards. So consequently, my mother, I told her, whether you sign for me or not, I'm going to go. I'll get somebody to sign for me. And I did. So she volunteered to sign for me, and I went in to the Marine Corps, and they said, no, we can't use you because you're colorblind. But go down the hall, they'll be glad to get to the Navy, and they'll be glad to get anybody. They're looking for bodies. And I did. I joined the Naval Reserve Merchant Marine, and that was in 1942.
Yeah, and as you said, you know, you went all over the world, and I want to hear about some of those adventures. But can you take us back to that 16-year-old kid and remember what your expectations were, what you really thought you were getting into?
My expectations were exactly what it turned out to be. I wanted to get in the fight as soon as possible, and I did. I went from boot camp right to the Pacific and went and joined a troop ship. We took troops to New Guinea. All through the Solomon Islands and New Guinea, made three landings in New Guinea. And then we came back to the United States. I joined a ship that was an ammunition ship. And we went to North Africa and from there on out, all over the world. And consequently ended up in Murmansk. First ship was the Sea Marlin. We transported Army troops to New Guinea and through the Solomon Islands. It's what they call the Bismarck Sea War.
And, you know, now with the lens of history, we know that being in the Merchant Marine was about the most dangerous thing you could do in World War II as far as the casualties and the chances of survival. Did you have any idea about that risk that you were taking at the time?
I did, because I figured they won't take me in the Army or the Navy or the Marine Corps, and I wasn't about to go in the Army, that I would take the chances, and I did, and I survived. February 23rd, 1945, the ship was 60 miles from the normal convoy. We hit a severe storm that destroyed our steering mechanism. The rudder and the main springs from the hydraulics split and broke. My job was at the time was pick up that 150-pound spring, put it back on, try to hold it in place while they were navigating the ship. We were a hazard to the convoy, so we had to drop out of the convoy. We were by ourselves 60 miles away from the convoy. So if anything happened, they would get us, but they would not destroy the convoy. And that's what happened. KG-26 found us with 23 JU-88 torpedo bombers, one solitary ship. It was touch and go. What they did was they flew left or port or starboard of the ship. One row would float down the left or the starboard or port side of the ship and strafe everything one way. The other one would come in the other direction and strafe the other way. So consequently, when they did torpedo us, they hit us in number 5 hole and blew the whole side of the ship out at that point. We were under general armor for that time, and everybody's at their battle stations and whatnot. So what happened was, after blowing a hole into the ship, we had a matter of minutes before the ship was going to sink. Because as the ship was going down, it was blowing the bulkheads out between the hatches and so on. I was ordered by the chief engineer, Donald Haviland, my chief engineer, he was a full commander, 3-striper, to get into the lifeboat. And the lifeboats were all shot to pieces, except for that one lifeboat was still in fairly good shape. It had a few holes in it, strafe holes in it, but it was still seaworthy. The other ones were just about shattered. So he ordered me in there to cut the lanyards because it was frozen to the davits of the lifeboat. You see what davits are? Mm-hmm. And the lines were frozen to it, so the lifeboat would not go down by itself mechanically. So I got in the lifeboat with a fire axe, and I chopped one line down, and the stern was okay. Just as I was cutting the bow of the lifeboat, a sea hit us, and the lifeboat and I went over the side. Well, when I came to, I was in the bow of the lifeboat. The lifeboat come down the back of my neck, and I still have that hump in my neck to this day. But anyway, I came to in the lifeboat, kicked my sea boots out, and I was able to right the lifeboat. The lifeboat was upside down. I was able to right it. And consequently, that's where they put all the Norwegian 19 women, 19 children, the list is up there, into the lifeboat. And they wanted me to get in. Well, I knew that was crazy. If I got in that lifeboat, I would freeze almost instantaneously because I was soaking wet. So I said, no, I will not get in the lifeboat. And I stayed in the water. I was able to get the life ring. And during all this commotion, I'd be 60, 80 feet in the air on top of a wave, on the crest of a wave, and the wave would break and I'd be down 60 feet below the water line. And I saw 2 seamen, a friend of mine, and I was able to push the lifeboat, swim with the lifeboat over to them, and I was able to save both of them. One of his name was William Wildridge, and the other one was Woodrow Wilson Posen, and one Navy gunner by the name of Warren Batchelor. And I was able to save all 3 of them. So, and when they picked us up, they took them aboard. When they dropped me on the deck, my eyes opened. They said, my God, they're still alive. And that's how they knew we were all still alive.
I don't know if you can hear the sound, but I think the sound is everyone's collective minds being blown by this story, because it just seems so remarkable, so impossible. I want people to understand one thing you said. You got the women and children in the lifeboat. They're okay in the lifeboat because they're not wet. But because you're soaking wet, you know, if I get up there, I'm just going to turn into a popsicle.
That's exactly true. They tried to get me aboard. They tried to, because when I righted the boat, they brought the children down into the boat, the women and children. And they tried to let me come aboard. And I told them no, for 2 reasons. One, the minute I'm in that cold air, I will freeze to death. And 2, I'm taking place of 2 or 3 children. So consequently, I would not get in the lifeboat, and I did not. And it was almost, I would say, probably 73 or 4 years later, I was awarded the Norwegian full citizenship with ambassador privileges, and I was also awarded their Congressional Medal of Honor.
Well, I've got to say, I mean, that's what was coming to my mind, because I've interviewed several who've received our Medal of Honor in the U.S. and others who probably deserved it. But what you're talking about surpasses a lot of those Medal of Honor stories. How do you feel about it? I mean, you're telling us about this like it's no big deal. Do you realize how incredible or improbable or almost impossible what you did was?
I look at it. I was there at the time, and I did what I had to do. And that's the way it was. I still feel the same way today.
I think what all of us try to do when we hear a story like this is put ourselves in your shoes. Maybe you didn't have shoes on at this point, but...
I had sea boots on when I was under the lifeboat. That's because they were tied up in the bow of the lifeboat with all those lanyards and whatnot. So I kicked my sea boots off, and I was able to free myself. And when I did, I surfaced, seeing the circumstances. The other lifeboats were all sunk. The women and children were trying to come down, and they had no place to go. So it doubled my effort to right that lifeboat. And I did, and I was able to put all... They were able to survive. When we got to Scapa Flow, King Olaf V of Norway met us there. He tugged me so tight that he almost brought tears to my eyes, and he had tears running down his face in gratitude. He gave us at that time one of the highest medals that they'd ever awarded, and it was the Norwegian War Medal. And 68 years later, I was awarded the Norwegian Congressional Medal of Honor.
And I'm sorry for keep bringing you back here, but I want to understand what this was really like. And I know it's 78 years ago, but we can tell your memory of it is still very clear. And 4.5 to 5 hours in the water, did that feel like an eternity? Was it going by quickly, slowly? What was it like in the midst of all of that chaos?
It was almost like a dead time zone, like your time stopped. To my knowledge, as my memory serves me right, I remember it was cold. I had a job to do, and I did it. And when they picked us up, they thought they were recovering bodies. That's how bad. I was on a life ring with three other people, Woodrow Wilson, Blackie Wildridge, and Warren Basler, and myself. We were so low in the water, thank God, that the sea breeze would blow a crust of ice over us. We were in almost into a cocoon-type atmosphere. And that helped save our lives, because had we been exposed to that sea on a steady basis, we'd have probably all froze to death. But as it was, the ice sheltered us, and being the way from the shoulders down into the sea, our bodies were starting to crystallize. And when they brought us aboard, they thought they were bringing bodies aboard. Because of the ice on us, they dropped me, and my eyes rolled open. They said, "My God, they're still alive." And that's when they discovered the four of us were still alive.
It's one of those things, this has become a cliche, but I mean, if you wrote this script for a movie, no one would believe it, right? That's what this is. So what about you? You're a teenager. As you're in the water and your body is getting more and more frozen and time is going by, I mean, you have to start thinking you might not make it, right?
No, I never thought that.
Never.
I always thought I'm going to make it. I don't care what. I will survive. And when I spotted... 1 minute I'd be up there and I could see everything around me. The next minute I'd be down below the sea looking up a crest and you couldn't see anything. And I spotted these three different seamen that I told you about. And I was able to swim to each one of them with that life raft and save them. And when we got together and that ice cone froze over us, they thought they were picking up a life raft with four bodies. So, like I say, when they dropped me on the deck, my eyes opened and said, "They're still alive." They took us down to the mess deck, laid us on a table just like that, or they're swinging tables. They went up to the officer's country and took bed sheets off the officer's beds, laid us on the table. They had to cut our clothes off, put the sheet over us, and they buried us in sea ice. They covered us completely with sea ice and let the body temperature melt the sea ice. It's the only way we'd survive, because they had no medication at all except for Fuss's Royal Navy rum. And the doctor at that time was a hell of a nice young man. He told us, he was a veterinary doctor before he served in the Royal Navy. And he says, "I don't have any medication at all. We've picked up so many survivors, I'm completely out of medication. But I have all the Royal Navy rum you can handle. Are you willing?" I said, "Hell yeah." And I've been drinking Royal Navy rum almost on a daily basis since then.
Well, it clearly saved your life. This is one of those where we need that disclaimer. You may not want to try this at home, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sorry that I keep bringing you back to things that maybe aren't as significant for you, but they're the questions that come up in our minds. as you're in the water for that long, hour after hour, clinging to these other guys, basically becoming a huddled mass of ice bobbing in the water, are you wondering, does anybody know we're here? Does anyone know we're alive? Are we ever going to get picked up?
The thought was, I hope we all get picked up, but it's not too likely, and I am not going to give up at all. I will never give up. So that's what was my thought was.
Were you even able to talk to each other, or was it too, yeah? What kind of things did you guys talk about?
We all mentioned the same thing. I hope we get picked up. Might not be likely, but we're going to survive. And our whole thought was survival. That was the most instantaneous thought in your mind at that time. I'm not going to give up. I'm going to survive, and I'll make it. And that's the way it was.
And I've talked to a lot of guys in situations like this, not exactly like this. I don't know if I've ever heard one exactly like this, but where it was extremely desperate. They knew they couldn't save themselves. Someone or something was going to have to save them. And some guys say, well, you know, we prayed and we really believed God was on our side. Other guys didn't have that kind of belief. What was it like for you guys in those moments?
Well, I can't speak for anybody except for myself. And my thought was from the beginning, I'm too young to die. I'm not going to die. And I'll survive one way or the other. And that was my sole thought. I will not give up.
And we know those other three wouldn't have made it without you, because you're the one that went and rounded them up and got them on the life ring. But have you ever wondered if you would have made it without them?
I didn't think about that at all. My thought at the time was, we're all together. Yeah. We're going to make it, regardless what. We are going to make it, and we did. That was my solid thought all the way through. I'm not going to give up, and I'm going to make it. And I've all felt that way all the way.
It's time for our final break, but hear the rest of that incredible story of survival for this now 99-year-old when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank, so the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-538-3328. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend. It's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is. Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode honoring a couple of birthdays. Richard Burbine just turned 99 in Bridgeport, California. That's on the eastern side of the Sierra Nevada. Pretty cold this time of year, but not nearly as cold as the water he found himself in on February 23rd, 1945, after the sinking of his ship, the SS Henry Bacon. Were you fully conscious and everything when they took you out of the water?
I'll put it this way. I was semi-conscious. You knew what was happening, but you didn't really appreciate how it was being done. By that I mean we were to the point where we were almost semi-conscious, and we could see what was developing, but we didn't seem to be able to react to it. And that was it until when they dropped me on the deck. It sort of woke me up out of a daze, and then I realized, hey, we are saved. And that's when they said, hey, these guys are alive. My eyes opened up.
How much of your body could you actually feel? How much did you actually have sensation in?
That I couldn't even tell you. I have no description of it because at the time, it was almost like you were floating, looking into your body. There was no feeling numbness or cold or anything else. We were to the point where it was blackout time. That's how close it was. And like the doctor said himself, he said another minute or so, I wouldn't have to worry about you people because the ice crystals were coming through the veins, through the body.
So he asked you if you want the British Royal Navy rum. So what did that feel like as those first few drops start to go through your frozen body?
It almost felt like a blowtorch going through your system. I presume that our body was so cold that the shock of this alcohol going through the body, it felt like almost like it was a low-voltage charge going through your body. That's the way it felt.
What were the hours and days that followed like? What kinds of stages of recovery were you progressing through?
Well, we were, from the time they picked us up to the time we went to Reykjavik, they took a lot of the people to Reykjavik Island because they were to the point where they weren't going to save them. It was a matter of choice whether they took them onto the mainland of Reykjavik Island or not. I feel that had they not taken some of these people, that they would not have survived because that's how far their body had deteriorated to the point where they just gave up. My personal experience was I'm not going to give up and I will not give up. And I didn't experience any of that. I just felt that it was a tingling, burning sensation as the feelings came back throughout your body. It was like you might put you freeze your hands while you're fishing or something of that nature, and it's slowly starting to thaw out. You have that tingling sensation. That's the way we were throughout, or I was, throughout my whole body.
You mentioned helping the women and children onto the lifeboat. What were they doing on this merchant marine vessel?
We'll go back to the beginning. The island of Suroyo is a whaling station in Norway. They produced fine whale oil. The Germans wanted it so desperately that they occupied the island and the 500 occupants of the island, and they took them captive. What happened was when the British Navy found out about this, they sent 5 British destroyers into Suroyo, and they evacuated all the ones that wanted to leave the island. A few of them wanted to stay behind because they didn't want the Germans to take over their property and whatnot, so they stayed on the island. But over 450 of them were evacuated on those 5 destroyers. And they took those people, men, women, and children, that wanted to go to Murmansk. Well, when they got to Murmansk, Murmansk's population was starving as it was. They had no place to put them, no food to give them. So they said, well, what are we going to do with these people? They decided to put as many on each ship that was in the harbor that could have support those people on each ship. We ended up with 19 women and children on the ship. Consequently, when we got torpedoed, they were the first ones to be evacuated, put into lifeboats. Norma Peterson up there was the 2-year-old little girl at the time it happened, and she's now a grandmother in Norway. She would correspond with the Navy people that saved her, and they would in turn tell me about her because they knew that she had been on our ship. And they would correspond with us and talk back and forth and with letters and whatnot. The individual that saved my life and the life of the 3 other people with me was a sub-lieutenant in the Royal Navy. He tied a heaving line around his waist, jumped into the sea, which is extraordinary. He did not have to do that. Went down, jumped into the sea, took one of us at a time, pulled us back up to the Jacob's ladder to the deck of the destroyer.
And he had to pull you because you couldn't pull yourself up.
We couldn't even help ourselves. We couldn't even loosen our hands from the fire, from the life ring. Mm-hmm. And he broke our hands loose from the ice, tied a heaving line around us to his body, and hauled us up to the deck of the ship. And his name was Ian Rodney Bowden. He was a sub-lieutenant at the time. He stayed in the Royal Navy after the war. He rose to be the commander of the Royal Navy yacht, one of the highest ranks in the Royal Navy. And he passed away a few years back. He did come to Tracy to see us. We had a good time, a few drinks, reminiscing. I've got some pictures of him up there if you're interested in that. One of the finest men I've ever met in my life.
You said you had a few drinks. Do I have to ask what you were drinking?
Royal Navy rum and Coke. He blew his mind when he saw the Royal Navy rum. He said, there it is. In fact, I gave him a quart so he could take home with him, and he laughed about it all the way.
What did that mean to you to have that opportunity almost 60 years after the war to meet him and be able to thank him with the lens of all the things you'd done since then?
I was able to thank the man personally, hug him, and thank him honestly for saving my life, sincerely believing that had it not been for him, I would not be there to even welcome him home and thank him.
Yeah, and your son who's with you here in Bridgeport, he wouldn't be here either. There's a lot of things that would be a lot different. I'm wondering about the other part of that equation, because you shared how you helped the women and children into the lifeboat and then how you gathered up those three other guys in the water. I'm sure you had some encounters later on with some of those people. What kinds of things did they say to you?
The only one I ever encountered after that was I was able to sail with two of them, Woodrow Wilson Posen. I sailed with him after the war, and William Blackie Wildridge. I sailed with him after the war. They were both engine officers, same as I was. Woodrow Wilson Posen, the last I heard of him was he was working on the Seattle Space Needle when they built the Space Needle. Remember that? Mm-hmm. He was one of the heavy operators on that when they were on that. The last I heard of him, he passed away years ago. Blackie Wildridge, he lived about approximately 6 years after the war, and he passed away. He was a young man, too.
Well, and that brings up another question. I mean, when you go through as extreme of a situation as you survived 78 years ago, have there been lasting effects? Have there been things you've had to deal with because of what you went through that day that most of us wouldn't even think of?
Never. I don't dwell on it. I never even think of it unless something comes in the paper or that jogged my mind.
So you haven't had problems with your fingers or your toes or anything else?
Never had any problem of any type like that.
Just the lump on the back of your neck?
Well, it's not a lump so much as it is a concave. Uh-huh. With the lifeboat hit me in the back of the neck, and it sort of concave my neck. But other than that, no. William Burr, I don't know if you heard of him or not. He was a young 18-year-old seaman at the time. 25 years later, they found his body on the shore of Norway, completely preserved, not a mark on him, frozen solid. And to this day, they put a monument at the exact spot that he was found, and his body was interred in Arlington National Cemetery.
I guess that's one thing we haven't had you tell us. How many people were on the ship? How many survived? How many didn't make it?
27 of the crew died, not counting the Navy gunners. And to this day, I don't know of any of them. In fact, I'm sure that I'm the last one that survived. Campbell, which was the radio operator, passed away about 4 years ago. And he was the last one that I communicated with at that time.
Well, and what about those who died that day? I'm sure you knew some of those people, right?
I knew the whole crew, every one of them. Like I say, I've never been able to communicate with any of their families or any of their relatives, so I don't know if any of them are still living or not.
Well, I bring that up because, you know, there were 406,000 Americans who gave their lives in World War II, and you came as close as anyone possibly could without being one of them, but here are dozens of your shipmates who made that ultimate sacrifice. What can you tell us about them? How should we remember them now?
I would remember each and every one of them as a friend, a loyal American, and a seaman to the day they died. They were just good, rugged seamen, and they did their job. They did it proudly, and they did it without any fanfare or any of that nature. That was part of that was their job. That's what they did, and they did it well. And I was proud to serve with each and every one of them.
And you've made it clear that your mindset was, I'm going to survive no matter what. And that got you through it. But when you tell someone this story and you see the look of disbelief on their face, or you even look back at it now at age 97 and try to figure out how in the world things happened the way they did, how do you explain it? How do you explain the impossible somehow being possible?
Well, since I was old enough to even reason, I have always believed two things. One, you are born on a certain date, and two, you're going to die on a certain date, regardless what or how or when. When your time is up, your time is up. If it's not, you're going to live it through like it wasn't even there. And I'm a firm believer, and I still believe that.
I don't want to leave anything out that's important to you. But one thing I really don't want to forget to say is thank you. Thank you for serving our country in so many different ways. You're still serving your community and so many people who don't even know what you're doing. And thank you for telling us a story nobody else could tell us. I want to ask you a couple more questions, and then if there's anything else you'd like to add, feel free. One, is there something you'd say that you're most proud of or most thankful for?
For living that long.
And you're still living. You're not coasting. You're not easing in to the end here.
I don't believe in being idle. If I was born a worker, and I was remain a worker till the day they bury me. I like to work, and I use my hands, and it keeps my body fit. It's some of the best medicine in the world is to keep busy. That's what my firm belief.
And because of that, because you're so active and engaged and forward-thinking, I'm wondering if there's something that's on your list that you haven't checked off yet. Is there something you're still looking forward to, still hoping to do or experience or accomplish that hasn't come to fruition yet?
I often wish, especially when I get up in the morning, I'm full of piss and vinegar, I often wish that I was younger again where I could do it all over again. And I would. I'd serve my country all over again the same way.
Even February 23rd, 1945?
Even February 23rd, 1945. If I had to do it all over again, I would voluntarily do it for my country. And I am proud of this country, and I love this country, and I'll die for this country if I have to.
And I don't think anyone's arguing with you. And, you know, you've mentioned a few different medals through the course of our conversation, the government of Norway, the government of Russia, and then our government finally caught up, and they said, anybody who served in the Merchant Marine, you're getting the Congressional Gold Medal. What did that mean to you?
It means that finally the government is recognizing what service you have done for the country. To this day, they still will not honor the Purple Heart. Why, I don't know. Why would they give you one Purple Heart for one part of the service and a different one for another part of the service? You're serving the same country. It should all be the same. And I feel strongly about that. And that's all I have to say about it.
Next month will mark the 80th anniversary of that ordeal. What a remarkable story. What a remarkable man. One final note before I say goodbye. This weekend, January 25th, marks the 80th anniversary of the end of the Battle of the Bulge. We had a special episode about the Bulge a few weeks back, but while we started this episode with the reality that only 66,000 American World War II veterans are still with us, and we always honor the more than 400,000 who made the ultimate sacrifice in the war, that Bulge anniversary made me think about one of those who made it home but is no longer with us. I know that 80 years ago this weekend, my grandfather, Dr. Robert Leffler, was extremely relieved that the Battle of the Bulge had ended, although simply the word bastone was enough to send shivers up his spine for the rest of his life. If he didn't make it home, I wouldn't be here, and I wouldn't have the privilege of bringing you these stories each and every week. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.